was when we were meditating, I had this song. During the holidays, I don't know the song, but you probably heard it. Our dear ones are near to us. Do you know this song?
Have yourself a merry little Christmas.
Yeah. I didn't get to the merry little Christmas, but I was in there. And those of us who are dear to us are near to us. And it was kind of interesting because I just felt like this is such a small group this morning. It feels kind of family style. And for those who are listening online, the temperature is 18 below. So you are hardy souls. So today, I'm going to talk about, I brought show and tell. This is a calligraphy that a friend of mine who lives out in California, who has been studying calligraphy for over over 20 years. And she actually has studied in Japan, and her calligraphy just changed not too long ago, and it's really become quite stunning. Her name is Val Zemanski. I studied with her at Udambara in Chicago. And she came here once to do a calligraphy workshop, and we always try to talk her into coming back, but we haven't been lucky to do that. She gave this to me when I started the youth practice and mailed this to me a little shortly after. And the translation came from Fudo Shin. Does anybody here know Fudo Shin? Oh, I thought maybe somebody would. It's a martial art term, actually. We had had a conversation about it. The translation of Fudo Shin is the immovable heart, the steadfast heart. I think in here she says immovable heart, mind. Oh, that's important. The immovable heart, mind. Well, there goes this talk.
The same word, shin, it's heart and mind.
Right. And I happen to know that this last character, the little U-shape, is the heart, is the part of the calligraphy that's the heart. So it's, I always see it in my mind as, you know, holding the heart. And then the three dots are the three minds, mind, thought, and consciousness. Are the three dots. So that's the heart, mind. And somewhere up here is immovable. So I wanted to bring and talk about it because in addition to youth practice, I find that lately, maybe in the last, I think longer than the election, really... it's been kind of gathering steam in the last 8 months. There's been a lot of agitation, and a lot of people have been coming here with feeling anxious and unsettled because these are turbulent times. And some of the things you hear are, I don't know how to cope. How am I supposed to cope in these turbulent times? Or how do I make sense of what's happening? And all the different ways I'm being pulled to participate. Or another is, what's the appropriate response? And that makes sense that you would bring those questions here because that's what spiritual or your spiritual center is for, is to bring those questions. Those are the questions, this is the place where we ask those questions. And one of the responses that seems to be helpful is to remind people that we are inextricably interwoven with all beings, really with all things. That's helpful because right away you're not alone when we say that. You know that your suffering or what you're experiencing is part of this huge web of life. And you can breathe into that, even if you don't know the answer to how to cope, or you don't know the answer of how should I respond. You can breathe into it knowing that. And the other is what we're experiencing, our suffering, is not personal. Which it feels personal, maybe, for some. Sometimes for me, it feels very personal. But it is part, if it's part of this woven fabric, then it's not. And the other thing is that suffering is part of the human condition. And it has been like this throughout all time. And sometimes when you are out in nature and you look at nature, you think all nature, even though they don't, suffering isn't a condition of trees or rocks, but there is a rub. There's a rub, and that rub kind of helps us grow. Not kind of, it helps us grow. It's part of how we grow. But sometimes when that rub gets too much, it doesn't help us grow. It actually paralyzes us or keeps us from growing. And the idea that we all, as human beings, are part of this condition, it just reminds us that people who seem to have it all, or things are going their way, are also suffering. I know after the election, I read somewhere someone had said, well, now you know how it has been for us the last 8 years, how we have suffered. And I thought about that, and I could feel my heart go, yeah, even though we have different belief systems maybe, than I have, I could see, yeah, they were suffering under the previous administration. And I didn't think much about that. I didn't think much about their suffering. But I am now because I'm connected to my own. So often we imagine that people who have it all are not suffering. But in a way, they are because they're connected to us. So the idea of spiritual practice is that we get to transform this suffering into a life-giving gift. That's what, when I come here, when I first came here, the interesting thing for me is I had achieved all my goals. I had achieved everything I had hoped to achieve, and I was so unbelievably miserable, and I couldn't figure out why. I had two healthy, great kids. I had a loving husband. I had a great job. We had a great home. We had great friends. I had educated myself and felt like I was kind of on top of my game, and I was so miserable. And so that's what actually brought me, because I couldn't figure out what's next. Why am I so miserable? And in the spiritual practice, I have been able to actually, now I'm a much happier person. through all the care that I have received in my from this Sangha, like Glenna. So the story of Siddhartha tells us how he makes this vow to end suffering. And he leaves the palace, and the story goes that for 6 years he studied intensely, gave wholehearted attention and practice with various teachers of his time. And though he learned a lot, he didn't find the end of suffering, and staying true to his vow to find the end of suffering kept moving on until finally he went into the forest with, I think, 6 other ascetics. And even then was not finding the solution or the answer to his vow. So he went and sat under the Bodhi tree, and last week we celebrated on the 7th day, the story goes, so the tradition is he finally realized the root of all suffering. And then something kind of interesting happens. His first thought is, wow, that's great, but this is too much for people to understand. I can't figure out how to teach it. It's too much. And then he's going to just go off and be a Buddha, an awakened one. And then who is it, Sōsan, that one of the characters, one of the figures in the story comes and says, no, 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 don't do that. You can't do that. There are people here on this earth who can hear your message. And you must stay and teach us. And the way he teaches is in community, just like this Sangha. In fact, one of the refuges we take is I take refuge in the Sangha. So one of the things I want to say is while we're here, we're practicing the teachings. And one of the teachings for me in the last, really, maybe over the last year, is I've been working with right effort. Or as Sōsan taught us in the class, that Thich Nhat Hanh calls it connected effort. And I really have liked
that. That's Tim Burkett.
Tim Burkett. Thank you. I like that. Thank you for correcting me. So connected effort, because that kind of gives you takes it out of being judgmental of right and wrong, and it kind of gives us an insight or an opening into what they're talking about with effort. And for me, working in youth practice, I have been using this Fudo Shen, or the steadfast heart mind, to hold me during difficult times in youth practice. I took over the youth practice not knowing anything about childhood development, not having any template for the youth practice, and needless to say, there's been a big learning curve for me. And in that learning curve are these very tender beings. And I feel like if I just come back to Fudo Shin, that I am doing connected effort in learning about the youth practice. Actually, one of the parents was the one who talked to me about this. And I wanted to say, and sometimes some of you may have heard this, that a big motivation for my practice, and especially in youth practice, is my children didn't get spiritual practice. While they were growing up, I was doing my spiritual wandering. So they didn't have that. So now as adults, what I notice is we don't have a language. We don't know how to talk about a lot of these things. And I see their struggles. And I see how difficult this is for them and for us as a family. So I feel real committed to the youth practice here. I feel real committed to the parents and the families here. And one of the things I feel like I'm doing for the families and for the children is I'm practicing Fudo Shin, a steadfast heart mind. And actually, there's a lot of that going on here. A lot of people here, a lot of the teachers here, a lot of the practices here are about Fudo Shin. And then I realized that actually that is a lot of what Soto Zen is. So even our Zazen practice is with an open heart, diligently sitting. Sitting with a diligent heart. And maybe when we don't feel that when we first start sitting, because all you feel are your anxious worries and physical hindrances. But if you continue to sit, you start to let go of those hindrances and you can just be or just sit with your posture. And it's not that that stays the same. A lot of times when I first started sitting here, I thought people just had these really great postures, you know, and they sat. And I wouldn't move a muscle because that was the instruction. But actually, I'm moving all the time now. All the time I'm making little micro adjustments so that I realize that that's how I take care of my body. When I sit for all day during sesshin, is I'm paying attention to my body as it's part of this structure of sesshin. So it's very important in our spiritual practice here that we do the forms, do the sessions, do the Zazen practice. Because that's how we learn our patience. We learn our soft, how to be soft and upright. That diligent or steadfastness requires our attention, requires our presence. And the soft and open heart keeps us from being manic. So a lot of people get very invested in an activity of which requires a lot of attention. And I know probably all of us have had things in our life like that where we just are on it. But not so much the open heart. Pretty much, you know, on it, on it, on it. When I was an architect and we had a project due, you had to be on what, during the construction process, you had to be on it to make sure, because once things were built the wrong way, it's too bad, right? Finally, I just would like to say, even our relationship with our teacher, when I think about my relationship with the teacher, really what they are providing is a steadfast heart for me. They, untold hours, have listened to my, so sorry, teachers, my neurotic obsessions about things. And they don't laugh at me, they didn't make light of it, they didn't shame me, they just received an immovable practice and brought me back to the teachings. I don't think I can impress how rare that is in my life to find that quality. I really don't know where else I find it but in my spiritual practice, in my spiritual life. So I wanted to say a little something about right after effort or connected effort as I've experienced it in Fudoshin. So in the teachings of the Buddha, in the eight great awakenings, or the eight awakenings of the great beings, which in and of itself is probably a Dharma talk, one of the eight awakenings of great beings is diligence. Actually, the way it was written was, inattentiveness is the obstacle to practice. And I would say practice is our life. Here. So inattentiveness in our life is an obstacle to a fruitful life. Without that, really, life can start to feel very constricted and very dead. So the Buddha says to the monks, with diligent effort, there is nothing that you cannot accomplish. So he gives an example of water and how as it drips on stone can drill a hole through stone. And when you think of water, which has is so fluid and easygoing, how could it possibly affect rock? So last night we had the teens had a fundraiser for climate change, and one of the comments you hear there, and actually in the Native American Bearing Witness retreat, was, how can I make a difference? It feels so hopeless. It feels so overwhelming. And of course, one of the responses, well, we have to do it collectively. That's how we do it. But also I'm going to suggest that we need diligent effort to make the changes that we want to see in the structure of our institutions, within the structure of anything that we're involved with. We need diligent effort with an open heart. So with diligent effort, what happens is we create a ballast in our life, like in a boat, in our little heart shape here. We create a ballast so that when these things hit us, when we something happens, and that is always happening, right? Life is full of the eight worldly winds that toss us about. Good, bad, gain, loss. With the ballast, we aren't so, you know, over here and unable to right ourselves. With the ballast, we can hold the things that happen to us in our life, and we can be diligent. We can practice diligence. And this is a great gift not only to yourself, but to you, the community and the families that you are in touch with. So the last time I talked to my teacher, she said, well, how are you and how are things going? And I was going through all the things that were happening. And she says, boy, it sounds like a lot of transitions for you. And we notice how difficult transitions are. We're going to do a big transition here in about a month, during the presidential election, because we're going to go under a very different regime, different governing attitude. What I notice about transitions is you feel very groundless, just like a boat. It's not like you can just go like this and hold on and get through it. You really are groundless a little bit. And so I wanted to read, I was reading Tejo Munich's little expert in right effort or connected effort in the book that just came out. I can't remember. The Eightfold Path. It was all women writers. She says, transitions in life are difficult. Even the ones we look forward to can be this way. We have to make all sorts of adjustments, which is true. We will all have to make adjustments. It's easier to stay with what is familiar, but everything in life is changing. One of the three truths in Buddhism is impermanence. Our minds try to hold on to what we already know, but it is already gone. And in a way, that's a good thing, because we wouldn't want to stay where we are, right? We want to grow. We want to change. We don't want to stay the same. But on the other hand, sometimes it's scary because it might be that it goes retrograde. We might actually become more entrenched in some delusion. So we're kind of lucky in this community because youth practice here provides us with lots of little bonuses. And one of them is that probably the most diverse part of our community is in our youth practice. And I get to listen to those parents, and I get to listen to the children, and now I get to listen to the teens. And they are talking about some difficult times, some entrenched attitudes that we have on, that we call racism. And I'm getting an earful. And now I'm thinking, well, how do we apply Fudo Shin to this, what I'm hearing? How do I stay soft and listen with my heart and be diligent? So, one of the things that we're going to do is we're going to, in the spring, or the winter and spring, we're going to start with some councils. And I've asked the parents, actually, to provide questions to lead a council practice so that we as a community can look at these things in a loving, heartfelt, but diligent way. And then Sosan and another parent are going to teach a class on racism, and you're going to use are you going to use the book?
Radical Dharma.
So this is an opportunity for us. You know, the definition of a crisis is opportunity and danger, and that's just where we're going to go. It's where we want to go. Because this is the place in our communities, our larger communities, where we get to do that with an open heart and in a productive way, a way that might actually fruit something. So I'm hoping that some of you here will come. Because we're going to hopefully touch things that will allow us to make shifts, to make some transitions. But when we do it together, we have a chance of doing something that is very positive and healing. And if those people who come are part of our community, it's going to change our whole community. And I'm really hoping for this, not just for our youth practice, but for our Sangha and for you as individuals. One of the things that I ran across was a reading on the Dharmapada. The Dharmapada is words of the Buddha written in verse. And this was a translation I read it in a book by Jerry Larkin, and I don't know that she translated it or it's just the translation she used. But usually it's called vigilance, and it looks kind of martial art. Vigilance, vigilance, vigilance. But she translated it into heedfulness. And for me, that was much more accessible for me, because vigilance puts me on alert. And my adrenal, it's like I almost can feel my adrenal glands go, okay. But heedfulness is, I'm in it for the long term. I'm in for the lifelong. And I can do that heedfulness. I can practice that heedfulness. And in the heedfulness, I can feel my heart mind supporting me so that it isn't constricted. It isn't exhausting. It actually is hopeful. So I'm going to read some of this, and I made a copy for anybody who wants a copy. You can just let me know. We can make a copy for you. But this is something you can use as part of your practice. But it starts out, heedfulness is the path to deathless. And deathless here is the infinite. So heedfulness is the path to the infinite. Inattention, the path to death. And actually, I have lived that part. When we are inattentive, things die. Maybe I'll speak a little more about that. The heedful do not die. Those who are inattentive are already dead. So heedfulness is the path to deathless. Inattention, the path to death. The heedful do not die. Those who are inattentive are already dead. I remember when I had my own business, there was an expression that was part of a group that I was part of that's, and their byline was, when good men do nothing, evil men rule. And that was a motivation for me to be attentive. And I'm suggesting we need to be attentive. We need to be attentive to our practice. We need to be attentive to each other. We need to be attentive. And then our heart mind will tell us what we need to do. And then it goes on and it says, understanding this, the wise rejoice in heedfulness. So it's not a burden. The woman who is constantly heedful is free. The man who is constantly heedful is free. Both attain nirvana. Happiness steadily increases for the person who is energetic, heedful, pure in conduct and kind. Persevere with your sustained effort, earnestness, discipline, and self-control. You will make for yourself an island which no flood can destroy. So that's like the ballast. No flood can overwhelm you. Fools indulge in inattention while the wise guard their heedfulness as the most important thing in their lives. That kind of goes on the same thing. You know, be heedful. But for me, the first one was what caught me. You know, really, how many times have we just not been heedful and done things and really felt totally empty afterwards? It's a kind of death. You know, it's like throwing your life away. You know, to just go through and the motions and not really bring your whole being to it. So, anyway, I wanted to mention that council practice, and I also wanted to say, without that heedful attention or diligent attention, our heart doesn't fruit much. We can be nice and kind, but without that discipline that we get from diligence or heedfulness, I noticed that really not much fruit comes from it. It's the two working together that create the amazing things that have changed this world. Women's suffrage, civil rights, whatever we're talking about, it's the two that work together. Heedful attention, diligent attention, and a heart-mind together, which is how I see Fudo Shin for me. So that's what I wanted to talk about today. There's lots of good stories, but I wanted to just open it up for a little bit for conversation. So that's what I have to say. So I'm just wondering if anybody here has anything to add to the conversation. Or if anything came through that you were thinking about that you'd like to share. Yes, Kathleen?
Maybe initially the inability to stay focused, but then habituated to one thing to the next, and then, like you said, the last thing you said about not being heedful, making, you know, decisions or behaviors, and then maybe regretting that. I have a daughter that's 23, and she seems to have habituated to probably initial attentional stuff, even though it didn't seem that way in grade school, but it's partly emotional. And I've been trying to get a hold of her for I've been asking her to call me for 2 weeks, thinking she had a place to stay with her girlfriend, and found out yesterday she's in Texas. And it's a perfect example of just exactly what you're saying, not being able to do that, not being capable of doing that, not wanting to connect with me, knowing I'm just stable and in the same place. So it's really such a truth that you're talking about, that this piece is connected effort, a diligent effort.
And those around people who have trouble with that have to be even more to support them. You know, they rely on the people around them.
And I don't have any way. I mean, there's nothing I can do. I mean,
no.
It's a complete powerlessness phenomenon, also when you're that close.
Right. Well, you can rely on people around you, Kathleen, to help you remain diligent and open so you don't exhaust yourself with worry. Because the five hindrances come into play here then, right? Because we're off balance. We get knocked off balance, and then we're kind of in that very painful place.
Yeah. And that's when I just realized why I didn't make it to the fundraising. I had it on my calendar, planned to go, but this was all tumultuous yesterday for me.
Too much.
Yeah. When you said that about the fundraising, I was like, oh my God.
Thank you. Chris?
So diligence and perseverance, are they the same?
Well, perseverance for me, and I don't know, other people might have different idea, but perseverance doesn't necessarily bring up to mind a heart with it. Perseverance is, though you're getting knocked down, you're persevering or you're staying with it, maybe, but not in a fruitful way. Perseverance doesn't maybe have this sound of fruitfulness, where diligence, you have a little more room.
So when you say heedful, you mean not just a flash fire of interest, like when we all get upset and we get this flash fire of energy, you know. What you mean is constant attention to just keep going even though it's hard, even though you think you're not.
Or even though it's easy. Keep going, even when it's easy. How about that? You know, a lot of people don't realize this when they start Buddhism, but at some point along the path, you kind of realize, oh, I see, this is a life, it's a lifestyle. It's a game changer. It's a lifestyle. It isn't just till the end of the session. At some point, it's not about the end of the session. It's not about the, you know, till I can get through this, raising my kids or... whatever it is, it's you. Oh, all the rest of my life, I will be looking at this stuff. All the rest of my life, I will be practicing, trying to receive. So, yeah. So heedful is kind of, when I hear heedful, I think I might be able to take that with me all the way to my last breath. Yes, Rob.
I find while you were talking that the word diligent is problematic for me.
Okay.
And I've tried to do the forensics on that and realize why it was. And I realized that it was what we were told by our president after 9/11 in 2001. We were told a lot, be diligent, be diligent, be diligent. And I just kind of remember thinking at the time, what does that mean? Does that mean be tense? Really worried all the time, because I think that's what we did.
Vigilant.
That's a word that is better. Vigilance is a better word.
Vigilant,
diligence too. But it's a similar sort of thing.
But that's exactly the point I'm making. That's a great example of what happens when you don't include the heart, mind. It is exhausting. And it is repetitive, and it's too much, and you then have this huge crash, and that's last night. Somebody, Magda, was talking about climate change. You know, like maybe we should, you know, sometimes we need to be careful and wise about the words we choose, and the speaker came back and said, "Yes, that's true," and he didn't want to take away that. But there was somebody had in the higher-ups of climate change said, let's not talk about it for 3 years so that those people who are opposed to the word cannot use that word and can be brought along and can open up, and maybe we can have a conversation instead of just no climate change. And then he said what actually happened was, the people who oppose talking about it or oppose it use those 3 years to really promote no climate change and really used it to their advantage. So it's words are powerful, what they say, but I forgot where I was going with this. What?
Words. Bring emotions,
right.
Tied to emotions.
Right. But he, And he suggested that, you know, sometimes you have to just stay with the climate change and stand up and say, you know, this, you know, all this stuff around climate change or that may not be going right, but to stay, but again, stay with the topic.
Vigilant was the word that should have been tripping me up.
Yeah, I have a hard time with vigilant, too.
But I guess the thing I'm kind of coming around to is the idea of it's easy for me to get to be, when diligence can bring on kind of tension and clinging, and it's harder for me to, I want to come around to a place where I'm kind of holding that paying close attention with an open hand.
So
feeling like it's not something that I need to be really worried about paying close attention. I just need to do it.
Well, I think another way we might look at it is a parental mind or a grandparent mind. You know, when we're with our children, you know, it's easy to pay attention to them, right? Well, what makes that easy is your love and devotion to those, to your children. So kind of think about, reflect on that, on it kind of like that. It's a, you know, kind of a big open field where they get to, and that's kind of, for my role in youth practice, is the kids come in and they can say anything, but and I can just say, is that so? Oh, okay. But I'm not raising them, right? So parental mind gets a little touchy that way. But grandparent mind, you know, you can say, oh, that is really interesting, and how is that working for you? Or, you know, you have a whole lot more space to respond from. But if you have that agenda thing that's, you know, got a goal to it, then it's a lot harder. So something, does that make sense, Maura?
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, Magda?
The gatha that we practiced during the last practice period was very useful for me. You know, waking up this morning, I bow with all beings, bear witness to joy and sorrow, responding with loving kindness, letting go. That was very important for me, letting go, so I don't cling to it.
Yes.
And in that space, the letting go is like, I did what I could, there is nothing else I can do, and I'm at peace. And then it goes, and beginning again. So there's like a pause there, just kind of a peaceful pause.
Beautiful.
That's very useful.
That's very beautiful. I love that. And we do need to take breaths. That doesn't mean we're not diligent. We're taking a breath. We're taking care of ourselves.
So that gatha was very, I was faced with a difficult situation with a relative that was, his health is deteriorating, and I went to see him, and I was happy to see him, but sad to see that his condition was deteriorating. So I did what I could, and then it's like,
I responded
with loving kindness, and then I let go.
That's very good. That's practice.
That's why it's so important, the practice.
Yes, it is.
Because it sustains us in hard times.
It's the ballast. Our spiritual practice is our ballast in life. And because we're not doing a lot of it in our larger community, I think we're feeling that lack of ballast in our culture. Did you have something, Tom? And then I think we should close up.
Just when you were talking about the youth discussing climate change, thinking this is such a big problem, how can I do anything about it? What's the point, more or less? And I feel the same way, but it's not just the youth. But it's the problem is that you can get attached to your outcomes, and that gets in the way of actually doing what's necessary.
Exactly. And so an open heart is different than that, right? Mm-hmm. A heart mind is not about the outcome. It's about taking care of this moment right here. So how are we paying attention to what's happening in this room with all the emotions that are here, or, you know, and we take care of that. And really, we say this all the time, but I really want you to know, I think it's just, if we take care of ourselves and we take care of our community and we do this work, it will have a huge impact. It will have a huge impact. And even if it doesn't, but it have the impact that you're thinking about.
Right. It has an impact on yourself.
It has a huge impact.
Right,
yeah. And the not doing it has a huge impact on you. The not taking care is having a huge impact on us. So I guess that's another thing that kind of motivated my practice. Okay, so either I don't do this because I don't want to do it. I don't want to face my karmic life. I don't want to take care of it. Or I get to just repeat it. I get to just do it again and do it again. And every time we do it again, it's more entrenched and more difficult to get out of. So buck up and flying fish, buck up and, you know, do your practice. Because that's going to hold you. So, and it has been true for me. So I urge you to think that way.
I also think as Buddhist practitioners, we do affect other people who haven't had the same experience of being exposed to the practice. So being diligent in the sense of, you know, having this permeation of your own being, interbeing, you know, so people would kind of get a sense of what you actually are, that is the way you proceed through the world. And that's really the diligence that you're requiring us, you know, because not everybody is in this room, not everybody has heard of it. They've heard of it, but they don't really know the essence of it. And so as individuals, us, we do affect that, you know, the words we use, how we interact with other people.
Right.
Well,
you really, going back to connection, that is how we actually connect. That's why we can sit in silence in Sesshin and still have a group body experience, because we actually do just receive, and feel that nourishment. To me, that feels like nourishment. I feel like it's a kind of healing. And the person actually doesn't have to say one thing. I can just tell that they are with me, and I feel connected to them. And that in and of itself is healing and nourishes me so I can be heedful. I can be diligent. If I don't get the nourishment, I can't sustain the attention. And that happens too. Oh my gosh. Have you been doing something? I thought you were going to wave at me or something.
It was in my mind.
Oh gosh, oh, sorry everyone, I really apologize. So.